tonight I am so thrilled to sit down with John Maida, really sort of one of the foremost thinkers on who works in the intersection of design and technology. His impressive resume sort of speaks for itself, but let me briefly rehash just in case. Former president of Rhode Island Island School of Design, degrees and distinctions from MIT, University of Arizona, and Maryland Institute College of Art. The author of four books. He now serves as design partner at the venture capital firm Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield and Byers. Please join me in welcoming John Maida to the stage. Well, John, to get the party started, I would sort of love to hear a little bit about what do you feel like constitutes good design? Certainly, it's not just something that's aesthetically pleasing. And beyond that, it's certainly not just about something that takes simplicity to heart, as one of your books touches upon the laws of simplicity. So in that stead, what constitutes good design?
Well, that's that question people like to ask, and it's really hard to answer. So let me try to frame it a little bit. I think good design is the kind of preparation call we had. I think the preparation was like, 30 minutes, we're going to make it happen. Every detail was touched upon. Yeah. I felt it's all going to work. Thank you. It was an experience that I felt this is going to be awesome. I arrived here. It was awesome. I felt we're going to start on time. It was awesome. I got to finally meet JP. This is great. And so this to me is the essence of what good design is, which is someone cared about making it great for me, for you. I also, today, I had the chance to kind of meet a few people, and I can't remember anything. I'm like the man in Memento. So I was talking to someone about design, and the first thing people say when this design, they'll say, well, it's like really sexy looking. That's what design is about, It's like, whoa, gotta love that, And I thought, well, there's sexy looking products, and there's sexy working products. And everyone knows what a sexy working product is. It's pretty objective. It's like, oh, how bad. Oh, good product, Sexy looking is different. There's so many things around it. So I think design is a sexy working product.
Can you give me one or two examples?
This conference.
Yeah. A sexy conference, sexy audience.
Well, yeah, I really mean it. What is it? Someone was asking me, like, well, is it Apple or is it like Tesla? Yes, it's all those things we love. But I got to say that one thing I've always felt is that, museums are great, but you got to go to the museum to enjoy that art. But as we've known through Instagram and other things, there's beautiful stuff like everywhere, right? You can go to the cheese table. Like, I noticed that the Swiss cheese, the hole was in the wrong place. It wouldn't look like a Tom and Jerry Swiss cheese. I wanted to move the hole. And that's almost art. And I think it's everywhere. It's just a question of, can you see it or can you not? And do you care at all? Because let's say I was really hungry, I wouldn't care. I just want to eat the cheese. I'm not going to think about what its aesthetic experience is. I'm really hungry. But let's say I ate. I'm like, oh, I'm kind of full. Do I really want to eat that? I'm looking kind of good. And so it is contextual.
If I were to sort of take a step back and maybe pinpoint or pick out one or two maybe tech products, companies, or services that maybe fill that niche, the intersection between tech, design, business. Like, for instance, years ago, I think you brought up the iPod as an example of a great, nicely designed product. Is there a contemporary?
Oh, by the way, I asked JP to take me apart on stage. So go for it. I love this.
Oh, it's exciting. Happening. It's going to happen.
It's happening. It's getting hot in here. Getting a little nervous now that I called him out.
Oh, this is just the warm up, John.
I brought up the JP. The iPod, one of my favorite things was the cable. Because the cable has that chip in it. requiring you to have a proper Apple accessory, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
What a great business model, right? It's like, it doesn't work. Why not? Because you didn't pay the license fee. You don't have the chip. And so to me, those kinds of examples underlie great business design thinking. And so it isn't that sexy looking thing. Mm-hmm. It's the sexy thinking thing that's paying for the sheen of what you're getting. You can't, the reason why we like an Apple product is because we can afford it, and they can afford to make it at a high enough margin.
Do any of any products in Apple's current line sort of fill that niche for you?
Ooh, nice question. That gets into that whole space of like, you know, what is good and bad, which I'm always cautious to sort of go around, but I'll go there because I like JP. People ask about the Apple Watch, the iPhone, the 6 Plus.
Let's just run through every single product.
Everyone.
In the product line.
Okay, Apple Watch, do I like it? No. When the Apple Watch came out, I looked at the price, and my dad's Seiko watch from like 1960 something was broken. I realized to fix it, it costs as much as an Apple Watch. So I fixed the watch. So that was my sort of protest. In terms of the iPhone or Android, you know, iPhone crashes a lot. Who has a 6 Plus where it forgets what orientation it's in? I'm like, whoa. I'm like, wait a second, guys. And so losing my love there kind of thing. MacBook Air. Love MacBook Air. Oh, my gosh. 11-inch.
You're getting really flustered over there, John.
To die for. Yeah, I know. You're letting this come out. I've never said these things before, so okay, I'm done. Whew.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let me sort of. So, January 2014 was a big month for you in the regard that you joined Kleiner Perkins as venture capital's first ever design partner. I think that's sort of really momentous in many, many ways. But I remember being there and thinking, well, that's an interesting move. How do you go from president of Rhode Island School of Design, or RISD as it's affectionately called, to the first ever design partner, so to speak? How did that transition happen for you?
Well, I didn't think much about it. I didn't know what venture capital was. I'd read about it. I noticed that every year, two of our alumni at the time, Brian Chesky and Joe Gebbia, like I met them at an alumni event where they were in an apartment and they had this idea and like, oh, I'm not sure that's going to turn out okay. And then like every year, oh, it's kind of turning out okay. And like every year, and they kept saying, you got to come here. There's something happening here. And I didn't know what it was. And I was helping Andreessen actually. Full disclosure, the East Coast, you know, get involved with RISD. So I knew that was something there, venture capital, didn't know what it was. And so when I was invited to do this, to try to be in such a firm, I thought, what a great opportunity, but I have no idea what I'm doing or can I do it. It was like when I became president of RISD. Because I had no idea if I could be president of college, but I read The Audacity of Hope, and it had this line, yes, we can. Yes, we can. So I was like, oh, yes, I can. You know?
So almost a year and a half later, how would you sort of describe what your role is as a design partner?
Three things. I work across the portfolio of companies, early, mid, and late, to figure out where design is useful or useless. I also source new ventures because my network is sort of a different shape than most venture capitalists. So I have all these friends from 20 years ago that were in tech and design, and now they're like, they have big firms, and I'm like, oh, I forgot, I knew that person, you know? Knocking the door, hey, hi. And the third thing I try to do is I try to find people in their late 40s who are in creative firms, agencies, to invite them to think about going the startup route.
Late 40s.
Particularly, yes.
And why is that?
Why? It does seem kind of aged, because I'm late
40s. I don't mean to be ageist.
No. Maybe it's because I'm late 42, so I want to subject them to what I'm experiencing.
What makes you feel any better? The CEO of Snapchat 2 or 3 years ago told me I was, quote unquote, over the hill and a member of the older generation. I'm 32.
Oh.
Yeah. So, so I'm not ageist in the slightest. That was my point.
You're tough.
So late 40s. Why late 40s?
Yeah. Well, it's because it's when you figured out how to lead at scale. Because creative people generally tend to not want to lead, because creative people are usually kind of artist-type people. They're always against power. Like, you know, I say, like, I was always against the man, you know, and then I was president. I was like, whoops, I'm the man. So that's hard to deal with. And so I think for a startup, you have to have leadership qualities, and those tend to, at least in creative people, surface when you're older. So when I say late 40s, 40s also fits, 50s fits, late 30s fits, even early 30s is okay. But today, that's when you tend to understand that leadership as a creative is not a bad thing. It's kind of a gift. It's an accepted thing to do.
Now, since you joined in January 2014, at least six other VC firms, yeah. Sequoia, for instance, Coastal Ventures, have brought in designers of their own.
Yeah.
And we've also seen a myriad number of creative agency acquisitions by larger tech companies like Facebook and other large companies. In your estimation, what do you feel like that's saying? What is the tech industry saying by bringing in designers like yourself and agencies like the ones that you've mentioned in the past?
Yeah. I think the important thing it's saying is, you know, when I was at RISD or even at MIT, at MIT I was the design guy. So I was like, oh, MIT doesn't care about art and design, blah, blah, blah. I said, well, what's the T in MIT stand for? Technology, right? So when I was at RISD, what does the D stand for? It stands for design. And so I was really pushing design and its role. But what I saw so often is that people from the creative professions tend to believe they aren't at the table. We're not at the table. We're not looked upon as serious, et cetera. I always found this approach one of Eeyore-ness, you know, Eeyore, Winnie the Pooh still works.
Winnie the Pooh, yeah.
You know? So to me, it was like, well, actually, look at this. There's a pattern. There is a monetary value being applied towards creative talent and creative output. Five of the top 25 U.S. Internet-only category in the CBI database, I pulled it out. That's nice thing to be a venture capital firm. I have all this data. And out of the top 25 startups that have had the most funding in the last 3 years, the recent raise, five of them were co-founded by designers.
Which ones?
Airbnb, Vice, Pinterest, Fab, and Lynda.com, which was acquired by LinkedIn for $1.5 billion recently. And that's a total of $2.75 billion were invested in designer co-founded ventures. And so you can't say, oh, we're not, blah, blah, blah. It appears to be happening.
So I don't mean to harp on, you're 48 or 49.
I think so.
One of the two. And so you've been around for a little while. How do you feel like design and tech has sort of changed or evolved over those years?
Oh my gosh. I'm so happy to be here because I feel a bit like Rip Van Winkle. Because I was like president for close to 6 years, which in internet time is like a long time. Because like the moment I became president, I was like the president robot. Before that, I was like, you know, writing code and doing all kind of things. I was like president robot. And then I sort of came back to take the, whoa, stuff changed.
How so?
Well, what struck me the most is, well, I mean, really, in full disclosure, I have learned how much I don't know. And every day here has been like, oh my gosh, I didn't know that. Oh, bad. And so I'm catching up to so many young people and their understanding of the mobile space. And I've been running as fast as I can. I've had great people. My former students have helped me as well over there from MIT. And so I feel like mobile is such a critical thing that has occurred. Not this whole mobile-only phrasing, but the fact that it's so pervasive, it's so people say, why is design so important now? It isn't that design has gotten important. It's that technology has gotten less important because it's good enough. Mm. At the same time, we use technology a lot. therefore it's got to feel better. Because we used to, remember when we used Eudora or some like Elm or whatever, like, oh, that was a poor experience. We did it maybe twice a day. Now we're like looking at these things like every other second. So if that's a bad experience, it's going to hurt all day long.
Yeah.
So technology has gotten too good, and we use it too much. That's why design has come in the foreground.
And I saw your presentation, Design in Tech, earlier this year, and you pinpoint that change, that inflection point, when tech really seemed to sort of catch up around, was it 2008, 2009?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And why was that?
That was because Mint. Remember Mint? Mint, you know, the beautiful, like, mint leaf, you know.
Personal finance service.
Personal finance in a category we all didn't like, which is, like, personal finance. Like, whoa, you know, that can never feel good. And design for millennials, you know, Web 2.0, it was Ajax-y. And also it was the first to sort of move over to a mobile app form. And Intuit gobbled that thing up. And after that point, in the Design and Tech Report, you can see how many designer co-founder ventures were acquired, one including Instagram, as Kevin appeared on the screen.
So you talked about how the space has changed. How do you feel like, you know, factoring in the business aspect too, how can sort of art and design affect like a company's bottom line?
Oh my gosh, this question.
Is that a bad one? Do you hate it?
No, I love it.
You do?
Because it's from JP.
Well, let's unpack it. Let's break this down.
That's good. Okay, so art and design. When you go to any university, there's maybe the art and architecture department. There's art and design. They usually sort of come together. What has happened over the past maybe 80 years is that the art part of design is winning in universities and colleges.
Mm-hmm.
So design that has to do with anything involving money or business is considered bad. However, the history of design has only been about money. It's only been about business. In 1966, there was a memo by T.J. Watson Jr., the IBM's CEO, if you remember T.J. Watson Jr., 1966, first line memo to the entire corporation, good design is good business. Lifted that from the Werkbund in Germany, Bauhaus. It was German economic, the German economic policy unit was focused on design because they were afraid of the British, who in 1851 had the Department of Science and Art that was funded in a large monetary sum to back something called the V&A Museum and the Royal College of Art, because they were afraid of the French. And it was all because they needed to make wares that were desirable. It's always been about the money.
Really? Even if we go back, walk down memory lane 5 centuries to those sort of very impoverished artists, painters.
That's art.
And we're talking about your definition of
design.
Fair enough.
That's why I go $DESign, like a rapper.
Yeah. Fair enough.
So we've talked about, you know, we've talked about your role joining Kleiner Perkins. You know, we've talked about Mint. Tell me, you know, let's talk about Apple.
We love talking about Apple.
But what you qualify as, you know, in the room, if we talk about good design, I think a lot of people might qualify, we'll think about unibody, aluminum chassis. We might think about what's on our wrists or what's in our pockets. You think Apple is a good designer, but for somewhat different reasons, right?
Well, there's two pieces to add to that, to build on that. First is at Kleiner Perkins, it was really exciting because I had a chance to address the entire partnership. There was like a summer thing, whatever, gathering, and so I had an hour to talk about design, which is pretty cool. So I knew I couldn't waste it. It was an important moment, and so I brought my Apple IIc. Which I'm not sure if you know the Apple IIc. It's a thin object. It's beige. It has a collapsible handle. It has a Kelly green switch. It has a beveled keyboard. It has a recessed audio knob. It has icons for all the ports. this was made 30 years ago in a time where no one knew what a computer was, adding at least $600 of cost in a category that did not need differentiation. Dumb idea 30 years ago. However, if you do design, if you build that culture and you keep doing it for 30 years, if you integrate over time to where design is important, it is the summed competency that Apple has in design that sets it apart. So any company that wants to design like Apple, it may take 30 years for them to get there. So that's one thing. The second thing is that, as we all know, if it wasn't for Tim Cook, Apple would have gone away because these wonderfully expensive things were too expensive and their margins were too slim. And so you bring in logistics, you bring in the magic that Tim Cook brought in, you know, to make it cheaper, to control the supply chain. Mm-hmm. The MacBook unibody, a perfect example.
I know that you love the MacBook Air.
Love the Air.
That being said, I must bring up the fact the MacBook Air design has not changed in the last 7 or 8 years.
Love the Air. Even when that new thing came out, I bought a new Air just to show it.
I will give you the design has held the sort of test of time, but it also hasn't evolved that much over time at all.
Oh, this is a good one. So, thank you. I want to talk about this. The reason why I didn't buy the new one is I had to buy a dongle. You know what a dongle is, right?
We're talking about the new MacBook, the one that just came out.
The new MacBook. I got to buy that thing to attach more things. I remember when there was a Duo 2400, the Mac PowerBook, whatever, and you had to carry the extra dongle. You're going to forget that thing. And so I forget everything. So I saw myself taking that book somewhere and say, oh, I can't plug in a USB thing, or I can't plug a... Oh, that is not sexy working well. But that's because, you know, I'm forgetful. All those of you who are not forgetful, I recommend the machine.
Fair enough. I would love to sort of pick your brain in sort of like what's called a speed round.
Okay.
I'm gonna throw sort of 10 to 12 questions at you. I would love to sort of your gut instinct or gut thoughts. Think of it as like inside the actor studio, but tech design style.
Okay.
So first is last year's favorite app.
Favorite app
of yours,
of mine, that I bought,
that you've used, product, service, company.
That's really hard. This is a lightning round. I'm supposed to like know off the top of my head.
Time's ticking, John.
Oh my gosh, I failed this test. What do I like on my phone? An app that I downloaded. Yeah, pass.
Okay. Wow. This year's favorite app, product or service?
How about this year?
Let's pick an app. Let's pick one app. This year's favorite app.
This year. I like movies. I can talk movies.
Something you can watch on your phone.
My favorite app. What is the app that I'm not liking a lot of the apps nowadays. They're getting me mad. So.
Least favorite app.
Ooh, that can get dangerous. Well, last year I did like Clear, you know, the clever note, whatever thing. But I can't organize myself well enough to make that useful. My favorite service.
Sure.
Pivotal Tracker.
Can you tell me more about that? I've not used it.
Love that.
What does it do? It's
awesome. It's like if you want to be a robot, that's a system you need. You know, I was studying agile, lean, et cetera, and everyone was using in the startup space. And I'm like, oh, this tool is, because I was trying to organize myself. So Pivotal is basically, if you think about it, it's like a big bowl of tasks you pour in, and out they come out like a machine. Boop, 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 like this, you know? And if you don't keep up, you're screwed. So I liked that kind of torture idea applied to getting things done. So Pivotal, there we go. Okay. Not a Kleiner company, mind you. Pivotal, there we go.
Noted. Good idea.
Not a plug.
Good idea, bad design.
You're talking about Pivotal?
No, that's the next question. Good idea, bad design.
Good idea. has like a lot of things. You just flat. I'm not good at this lightning type of thing. Good idea, bad design. There's so many things like that. Like this thing. Like I'm not this color. you know, I like it. It's a good idea. This doesn't hurt too much, like some of those things. But this is kind of obvious. This isn't one made for me. So that's my answer. Okay.
Most overhyped trend, product, or service.
Overhyped trend, design. I really mean that. I just want to make it very clear that design, all design is not important. All design could be relevant, all design is good, etc. But in terms of material impact to this tech economy, certain kind of design is not going to bring you magic. It is the design that's happening in this region that is so unique. It is so different than other types of practice design.
Is there an example that you can sort of...
Who's a designer here in Silicon Valley? You guys do something that most design schools and design agencies cannot do, which is design for a live surface at scales of millions of people. This is something that was never possible until the last few years. And it's designers who are doing that, they're designing in a way that no one else can design. And so that kind of design is valuable. If you can design a chair, I love your chair, but you're not going to have a material impact on this startup. If you can design a great texture, it's going to be great in my house, but it's not going to have a material impact on the app economy. It is designers who can live across technology and business thinking that are really making a difference. And what I feel sad about, if I have like a sad moment, I feel sad that there's no way for this group to really be seen with a clearer lens and for standards to be appreciated. Like museums don't collect, like the MoMA does not collect this kind of work. And so lots of this great work is being missed every second. So I feel that in my bones, I'd like to do something about it. So I do, I'm aware of it, and it bothers me.
Best piece of advice you've ever gotten? Best piece of advice you've ever gotten, received.
Oh, best piece ever got. Oh yeah, well that would be, that was from, he was the CEO of an insurance company, Bob. I love Bob. And Bob said to me this thing. What was it? Holding a grudge is like eating poison, hoping the other person dies. That's my go-to. Like whenever I'm like, feeling the Hulk, I'm like, no, I'm not going to let you get me angry.
Noted. Yeah. Okay. Worst piece of advice.
Oh, lots of advice. Worst piece of advice. Gosh, there's so much. I like to think that people who take advice get that. That's like a default option. What's the worst advice I ever got? I may not be able to answer this question. I may have to come to it later. It takes 5 minutes.
It's a lightning round, John. Or
no, no, lightning round.
It's supposed to be the lightning round.
Okay, all right, okay. I'm going to stay to the rule. JP, go get me. Thank you. Where's the other guy? I think the worst thing that I did. Does that count? No. I'm an introvert.
Like we're verging on this personal.
Introvert. You know. So the worst piece of advice I ever. Like, let me say that. I'm asking something, and someone told me something, and I did it. Like, oh, how many things was that? What can I disclose in that category without getting in trouble?
Okay. So. Okay, we'll skip it. We'll skip it.
Oh, no, no. yeah.
All right, all right. Yeah. I know you tried. How about worst professional mistake?
Worst professional mistake? Oh, is that similar? they're kind of correlated because someone gave me advice and I made a professional mistake. Oh, well, that would be that's a good. And it was in 2001. I was a junior professor at MIT, and actually, no, this generation of graduate student doesn't know it over there, Laura Martini and Kyle. I remember I was like a fourth year professor, and the Media Lab, co-founded by Nicholas Negroponte. Nicholas wanted to retire. And once he wanted to retire, all the powerful people wanted to be in charge all of a sudden, and he didn't like that. So as a science experiment, he put the two guys in charge that didn't want to be in charge. And I was one of them.
And how'd it go?
It went bad. Because, you know, I was like, you know, junior professor, I wasn't tenured, so it was a bad thing to do, people said, but I was crazy, you know, you're a maker, you can do stuff, you can figure it out, it's all right, you know? And it was within a few weeks when I realized, and people were asking me about, like, the toilet paper in the Media Lab's bathrooms, and so-and-so hates someone else, and I was like, whoa, this is hard. This is really, really hard. I am bad at this. And so after a year, I resigned from that post, actually, and went to the mountains and studied organizational behavior and got my MBA because of that.
Oh. So worst mistake turned into a great life experience.
You have to.
Fair enough.
I like to say it isn't about failing fast, it's about recovering fast.
Well, you know, I know a lot of people in the audience would love to sort of hear what you sort of see happening with regards to how do you sort of see design and tech evolving over the next 10 years or so? Mm-hmm. If I had predictions,
yeah.
What do you sort of see happening?
One prediction I see, and this is based upon data, is that design is going to have a bigger impact in the C-suite. And it's particularly because of two recent acquisitions. The most significant one is McKinsey and Company acquired Lunar Design, which is significant because if you look at the history of IDEO, great firm, you know, it's everywhere, like World Economic Forum, it's battling, you know, it's got like big fists, it's like fast, it's powerful, but it's a hard trek up to the CEO category, that C-suite. McKinsey already sells to the C-suite. This is a whole different category. And so that's opening up a whole new space. What I think is going to happen because of it is we're going to see we think of CFOE companies. CFOE companies, you know, they can get the numbers, they're doing it right. I believe that McKinsey, that this kind of new work will allow design to be a little more numbers-based, especially because of the good work that's being done by the designers in this region that can instrument things, because design was never instrumentable. So that's going to happen, I believe. I'm also kind of down to also, a negative prediction also, is that hype around design is so large that because there's so many kinds of designers, startups are picking up designers not knowing what kind of designer to hire. So
can we unpack that a little bit?
Yeah.
Obviously, there are a lot of designers in the audience, but for those who aren't, what exactly does that mean? They're just basically onboarding designers for the sake of onboarding designers?
They need design's important, so we need design people. So we'll find the designer that, you know, someone said it was the right designer, they bring the designer aboard. The designer doesn't have any kind of understanding of analytics, doesn't really care about team building, wants to sit in a black, you know, a dark room by themselves and listen to music. Not going to work out.
So not just like skill set mismatches, but also personality.
Doesn't fit. And I think because design is hot, you look at the title, looks design, you feel the design thing. And my biggest concern is, oh, we hired a designer and that didn't work out. So, you know, this whole region is about fast thinking. So if the pattern broke once, then the pattern is not correct. And so that's what I'm really concerned about. And a lot of what I try to do is, what's great about being at Kleiner Perkins in the portfolio is I can work with a lot of designers across, like Randall over there, you know, to sort of link together designers across to help them be seen as not that kind of designer. There are people who are closer to product.
Got it. Any other predictions? Sort of see coming down the pike?
Predictions. Let's see. No, that's all I got for the prediction pocket.
You mentioned Thank you for those.
Thank you.
You mentioned IDEO a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
Didn't they sort of push forward with a certain design thinking?
Oh my gosh!
Yeah. Oh no.
Now know what design thinking is.
What can you? I'm not even quite sure. I know
so
what design
excited.
Thinking is.
I'm so excited. Okay. I've been told it so many times that I had to figure it out. So today I was in a meeting at Stanford GSB, and someone was talking about design thinking for like the millionth time, maybe the thousandth time I've heard. Like, I got to figure out what this thing is. So here's what it is. this is not like edited or whatever. I may not remember writing. Design thinking is the capacity to believe that a better idea might exist. And it is a set of tools to find the better idea. I think it's as simple as that. It's the fact that if you're in the busy day-to-day, you're executing, you're incrementally executing, you believe that what you're doing is as good as it could be, because they've been doing that for the last 10 years, it's working, don't break it. Design thinking attempts to say, well, actually, maybe there is a better way, and maybe you might know what it is, because you see the customer every day. I could make up the idea, but why don't you figure it out? The other half of design thinking that is the hard part is to implement the change management part, to make that actually happen. But design thinking, at least, I think, does work. It lets anybody look at the problem, understand the root cause, have a methodology to figure out what possible things you could do. It doesn't solve anything, though. It helps you find the solution, or believe that it helps you imagine that a solution could exist and invent it. It doesn't help you implement it.
So earlier today, we were talking.
Is that okay? I could get in trouble for that one.
It was great. We were talking a bit about the cross-platform cloud experience. It's a lot of jargon, but let's unpack that. Talking about companies like your Facebooks of the world, who obviously they're cloud-based, and they're very inconsistent with regards to the experience on desktop versus mobile, and then within mobile, tablet versus, I don't know, watch versus whatever. Talk a little more about that, but also, are there any companies that are actually doing it right?
Well, I was mentioning JP before in our time here. I've been trying to figure out how to program again for multiple screens. I'm from the era of like X Windows, and I did some like, you know, OS X type of stuff and Next Step, but I could do all that. But this cloud and compression and hitting these different screen sizes, I got to understand this. So last 5 weeks, I've been going deep into it. And boy, do I have sympathy and empathy for all of you who try to do this. Because it is through that process I realized there is no right way. And the right way keeps changing. And it really isn't good enough, because it either addresses a speed or size issue, but doesn't address the actual experience quality issue. It doesn't address all the factors that you might want to design for. And I was just like, oh, this is why it's so hard. Again, I have a lot of empathy for what you guys are trying to achieve, because people think it's like this, you know? It's not.
Are there any tools or any sort of solutions that you sort of see?
That's the problem. There's too many tools. There's like every tool does one part of the thing, and one tool can do all of it, but it's missing something and it does it crappy. And so like I'm just so struck by that. So I think that a lot of things like compilation have been solved. You know, parallelization, basic computer science issues have been addressed fully at scale, you know, containerize this, blah, blah, that. But the way to sort of work with assets across these multiple, highly fragmented, even this isn't fragmented though, it's a notepad, it's not solved. And I have a lot of empathy for people trying to meet the demand that it should work.
Right. Well, now let's go to some questions in the audience.
Ooh, the microphone sound happened.
Microphone is ready. Any questions?
Okay.
Yes, you, sir. Middle.
Yeah. Ooh, complex.
Hey, John, I'm going to go first. If you could redesign any site right now, which one would you redesign?
My site.
Sorry, a public company site.
I'm currently liberating my data from WordPress. It's stuck in there. I cracked open the XML file. I'm taking it apart right now. I'm mad. So my websites have to get fixed.
Oh, actually, we should wait for the you first, sir.
Hi, John. So one of the complaints about a lot of designers in the Bay Area is that no formalized, like, previous design program is really preparing people for the demands of the industry at the time. So I'm wondering, sort of like, from everything you've learned at Kleiner Perkins now, if you went back to RISD and you were president of RISD again, like, what changes would you enact in the educational programs there based on the things that you've learned?
Oh, well, first of all, I think at RISD, a lot of my job was to not mess it up because it does a lot of things well. And if you see it today, it's doing a lot more computation. But again, that wasn't me. It was in a pipeline phase, hiring the right people that could do that. So I can't take credit for all that, what's happening now. I don't think schools are changeable. I don't think they're malleable. I was a tenured professor. When you're a tenured professor, you can't tell me what to do. And so universities are built upon systems where people can stay there in perpetuity, they can't be fired, and they're going to live too long. So, and there's no incentive to change. There isn't a performance evaluation program. There's no OKRs to be a professor. So that's not going to change. What I do believe is going to change the quickest, if there was a prediction, it's business schools. Because business schools are businesses. They're market-driven, and so a lot of my work you'll see over the next at least 8 months, eight to 10 months, is focused on top-tier business schools bringing design engineering closer there, because they'll listen.
Next question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My question was about, you said something about design was never instrumentable. So what exactly did you mean by that? Because I can see sort of two ways of looking at it. You can say that the workflow of a designer wasn't, or the goals of a designer were not really instrumentable, or you can even say design inside business was never really instrumented or measured or tracked, or in a way there was no sort of a bar for performance, that kind of thing. So how did you mean it, and what would instrumented design look like?
Good, thanks. Thank you. Business has always been instrumented. Did it make more money? Yes. Did it make their money? No. How much more money did it make? It was easy to understand. It's always instrumented. Design before these before networked computers existed, you would guess, and it's I hope you like me, and then it goes out there. Oh, everyone likes me. They bought it. I'm awesome. Or like, oh, it went out there, no one likes it because you guys are lame, you know? And so it was guessing. When we sold shrink wrap software, it was guessing, you know? Update cycle was very sparse, you know, we keep guessing. In this new world that you all live in, it's a live surface. It's living out there. You know how many people are touching it well, touching it poorly. It's instrumented. That's what I mean, that you can actually tell how the thing is being used at scale. And because you can do that, it's powerful, because it means that you can talk about how well it's being used. And therefore, design has a huge opportunity to be able to say, this is actually being used more. Now, people will say, well, it depends upon the goals. If it's a conversion goal, it could like mess up the design. I know there are problems in how software is instrumented today, but I believe it's the beginning to something very powerful, where just like money and quality, these experiences can be measured as well. I look forward to that. Thank you.
Next question.
Hey, so you mentioned your prediction about designers marching into the C-suite. So my question is regarding leadership and the creative drive.
Yeah.
Because leadership, as we know, sometimes involve tasks outside of creating. So I guess my question is, how have you dealt with it, and what advice do you have?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I consider myself that classical introvert. I'm like a software like nerd, and then I'm like a design nerd. Like I sit with like a like Helvetica moving the H, like, you know, 0.01 points here. Not right. That's kind of, you know. And so I love that world of making. And people who make tend to diss people who don't make. I was at RISD. I used to hang out on campus. I'd eat lunch with students. I'd walk around with Trey. So if they didn't want to sit with me, it was okay, but I was a little sad sometimes. But I would just hang out. And one time I was talking to a student, and then I was walking along, and then a student came up to me and said, "Hey, John, I saw you talking to him. You shouldn't talk to him." I said, "Why?" "Well, he's a talker. I'm a maker. You want to hang out with the makers, John, not the talkers." And I said, "Well, aren't you a talker? You're talking to me, you know?" But it's this notion that the talkers are talking and can't be trusted, but the makers can be trusted only because we make. I believe that leadership is about making through talking. It's through making networks occur, making possibilities for others occur, for that making to occur. It's probably it's 10,000-fold more interesting making than the actual making itself. So to any designer who becomes more senior, I urge them to read the work of John W. Gardner, one of the great scholars of leadership. If you like Kerning and Ritchie version of C, you have to read John W. Gardner's book on self-renewal and excellence. And they're great short books that give you a taste of what leadership is about, which is basically making, but different kind of making.
Next question, miss.
Hi. You're sort of the first of, hopefully a lot more who are makers that are also becoming into leadership roles, but there's not really a correct path for business. It's like go to business school, get an internship, work at a consultancy. So what is it that us as designers need to do in order to kind of further ourselves? Is it go to business school? Is it do like more pixel pushing? Like what's your advice?
Yeah, great question. Well, on the one hand, I'm trying to figure out how, and actually not just myself, there are many design leaders out there in the different late-stage startup space and also large companies who are trying to imagine what kind of programs could exist for designers who want to lead. Some of them are out there. I plan to actually put them all in one place on the web because I've been collecting things. The second thing is just to have the attitude that leadership is okay, that I'm a maker and I'm a talker, and I can make talk. I think that's an attitude to adopt and to seek out ways to learn. Let me give you an example. I remember at MIT, I was on this committee, institute-wide committee with 30 professors across whatever, and it was run by Dean Bob Silby, Dean Silby of science. He could run a meeting. It was an hour and a half. We all got our say in. It ended in an hour and a half. Unbelievable. I was like, what the heck is he doing? So if you can see that that's a design, that's a making, and get a thrill out of it, you'll find something wonderful there, I hope. Thanks.
And you should check out Jira. It's way better than Pivotal Tracker.
Okay, nice. No, I that's good. I will try it out now. Thank you.
All right. Next question to you, sir.
Thank you. Poor Tim McCoy of Pivotal.
How much do you see wearables and speech interfaces making technology invisible and eroding the role of visual in industrial design?
A lot.
is that a full stop?
Well, yeah.
Okay. Next, yes.
Hi. This question is about team building for designers. So I feel like there's kind of two polarizing attitudes towards team building. So one is to have a very strong singular vision where one person has a great vision and everyone else kind of in a hierarchical attitude follows and executes that vision. The other attitude is to have a very democratic, collaborative team environment. Which do you think is optimal?
Oh, well, I would use analogy. So those of you who are from design or whatever field you're in at least graphic design is a very strict form of typography, like Swiss typography, it's called. It's like the right way. And if you do it the wrong way, you will go to hell. And then there's British style. It's like free. It's like spit. It's like whatever, you know. Like, whoa, you know, crazy, you know, kind of thing. I used to be Swiss, and then I escaped from the Swiss people. And I came to this world. But I now go back and forth. So I would say it depends upon the situation. In a time of crisis, you need to hierarchy up, because you do need that kind of leadership. In peaceful times, when you can actually leverage the team's creativity to perhaps to design, think, or innovate out of an existing process, participatory, but back and forth. Thanks.
Yep.
want to go back to this idea of makers versus talkers. What advice would you give to, you know, someone who is a senior maker and is trying to move to the big table and is fighting a perception of us makers as sort of, you know, we're pixel pushers or craftsmen, whatever the nice analogy is, we are still the doers and not really the thinkers. And that's a really big problem that I've noticed here, especially here in Silicon Valley, that is so dominated by business and technology, that we're sort of like, you know, this exotic bird. If we do show up at the big table, we are the exotic bird.
Sorry, I don't mean to be rude. Your question being,
how do you deal with it? How do you cross the bridge? How do you initiate the dialogue and change the perception?
Well, you know, when I was at MIT, I remember there was this problem that was political, and there was this guy that was doing everything to stop me, and I was like, whoa, why is this guy wasting all his time? And then talking to one of the deans, and then told the deans I wasn't a tattletale, so I just kind of like described the situation. He says, well, John, don't worry. Wait till they die. Which was really useful advice, you know? So I'm not saying wait for them to die. But I am saying that...
there are too many CEOs who are in their 30s here, that's not going to happen.
This situation will always be prevalent if you're in the minority camp. And it's a great situation to be in. I think the worst situation to be in is everything is okay, because you don't learn anything. So I've had countless people tell me, I mean, even now, I'll have people come to me and say, John, what font should we make this? John, could you design the certificate? John, could you choose the color? And every time, I'm careful not to hurt somebody. But that is what I do. I follow along, I find ways to cope, and I try to do things that have a material impact because I've seen it's possible. So I would say where the blockage exists, make new paths. It's possible, but if you stay here, it's not going to do anything. They're out for you, and they will stop you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. I realize we have quite a few more people, so maybe each person could take 10 seconds and...
All right, I'll go quick. I just wanted to go back to the point that you made earlier about finding a good designer and, like, finding the right designer for the right job. And I was wondering, like, how do you go about that? Because I feel like sometimes jobs are just like, you know, you're looking for a unicorn. And I'm looking at a task, and I'm like, what's the right person for, like, this partnership? Like, do you have any tricks, or how do you find people?
Oh, I think it comes to events like this. I really mean it. I think that makers are introverts. They don't want to hang out. They kind of want to make. And I think that if you want to be a leader, I think, and you want to find more people, it is about meeting people. It's about being curious about other people than yourself. And I know you do that, given your background, your success. I'm a very shy person. I would rather be sitting and making. But I used to have a producer. His name is Inami Naomi. And I made these books in the 90s. They're called reactive books. They were interactive books. And I could do it because he was my producer. He was my venture capitalist. I remember I was at a party somewhere in Japan. I didn't want to hang out at the party. And I just wanted to go make my thing, you know. And he said to me, it was in Japan, like, Mr. Maeda, you just have to go to the party. And I said, no, I just want to go to the party. I just want to, you know, make my thing. And I'll never forget, like 3 months after that, he became very ill, and he never returned from his state. And I realized that no one was going to talk for me, so I just had to come out and try to make a difference. And so the answer is what you're doing, so thank you for coming out and asking a question. It's brave, so thank you.
Next, please.
Hi, I'm Lucy. My question is, in your opinion, what is the best way to measure a good design? Is it by the money it makes? Is it by the kind, like, how much people, how functional it is? Is it by how pretty it is? How do you measure it without it being launched?
Yep. The great thing about doing my MBA was I became less afraid of money. And I became more aware that you can either be very successful financially or it can be unsuccessful, or it can be neutral. If you be neutral, you're controlling your weight, do you see? So, and that's the question. If you need to design something to make money, it better make money. If you have money, then you can, the next time, make something that doesn't have to make as much money. Does that make sense? And so you control what you can do based upon what you set as your financial goal. Have that power. It'll free you. Paul Rand said this to me. Paul Rand, the graphic designer, the famous graphic designer who did the IBM logo, etc. I was at his house, and I was there alone with him, and I was working on his last book because his assistant hadn't arrived that day. So he opens the door, and I was just arrived from Tokyo. I was going to have a half-hour meeting. He says, "You will work for me today for free." And he was like 81 years old, kind of like a god of graphic. I said, "Sure, no problem." So I spent the whole day with him. And it was around noontime. I was kind of hungry. And I was like, I can't ask Paul Rand for a sandwich, but there's nothing around here. And so he gives me a sandwich. Oh, thank God he fed me, you know. And then he gets really quiet. And he says, "Young man, I have something very important to tell you." It's like a Yoda moment, right? Like, oh my gosh, this is going to happen. Make lots of money. I was like, whoa, Paul Rand, you can't say that. But he said, it isn't what you think. It's the fact that I've learned that the things that I don't like to do can often make money. Things that I love to do tend to lose money. So I make money to fund the things that I love to do. An example, he gave the fact that all of his first books were printed in 5-color, and Yale Press couldn't afford that. So he paid for that printing. And so I think it's a pragmatic, simple, 81-year-old advice. If you can control your financial spend, you're in power.
Thank you so much.
So we only have maybe a few minutes left. If you,
Earlier you mentioned that you were kind of a witness to Airbnb's success and how they took off. And I was just wondering if during your career there are any like ideas or teams who you've met at an early stage where it's kind of everything's uncertain and you thought, oh, that's really interesting. And then it's just like one of these things that goes out into the world and changes things. And I was just curious if you had any other stories about things you've witnessed that have gone on to really succeed.
Ah, so many things like Etsy, Kickstarter. I would see them happen. Yeah.
One thing.
Etsy.
Yeah? All right. Next.
Often the conversation around business and design is us versus them. And I'm curious how you see that conversation evolving.
It is us versus them. Now it's us with them. That's why I spend all my time in these business places to build those relationships. They're talking.
What paradigms or habits have impacted your life the most?
Knowing that I'm going to die has changed my life. I have met so many people in my 20s who told me that, life looks like this and you die. Four quarters. Mitz Kotzok told me, your life is lived in four quarters. 0 to 25, 25 to 50, 50 to 75, 75 to 100. He said, don't forget, John, most people don't make it to the fourth quarter. And that light turns off. And your third quarter is hard because your body begins to atrophy. So it's hard to focus on your work. And so you're in your second quarter now, John. Don't mess it up.
Sobering words. All right, Eunice.
This is a dark evening. Sorry about that.
Hi. So I have no experience in design at all. I'm trying to build a prototype for a startup idea I have. So I just draw something on the paper. So I'm looking at it. So what are some questions I can ask myself to make the design better?
Well, I think what's critical is that when, first of all, you are designed. My professor in industrial design, I once said to him, there are people that really don't understand. I mean, most people don't understand design. And some of us, we get design. And he said, no, you're completely wrong. Everyone understands design. Everyone, when they get up, they open the closet, they choose what to wear. They might modify how they're wearing something. You're wearing that. You're choosing who you are. And so design is about choice. And so intuition is choice. However, in the world of instrumented design, that is not good enough. And so you should think about how that relates to the data-oriented design that's emerging here. That's going to be a more powerful play, I believe, if you want power. If you don't want power, it's okay.
Right. So 1 minute left. One last question for you. It's an informed tradition, basically, to ask all our speakers the following question. No pressure. What is your 60-second idea to change the world? John Maeda.
This is like a lightning thing, too. I'm terrible at the lightning
thing. You skipped some of mine earlier.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know. If I knew, I wouldn't be here, actually. I've been working on it. Intuitively, I think it's about bringing people together around these themes, about talker makers, about instrumented design, about business schools accelerating things. I think that my whole life has been about having a dumb idea, but finding that others shared in that dumb idea, and it turned out not that dumb. And I can feel like I made a difference in my life. I'm hoping I'll feel that. That's my goal.
I'll take it. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us. And let's give John a big round of applause.
Thank you,
JT.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.